RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I've come to Hoxton, one of the creative quarters of London, where it's said that there are more bearded hipsters per square foot than anywhere else in the city. This is where my guest today lives and works. She is the graphic designer and artist, Morag Myerskoff. After leaving the Royal College of Art in 1988, she spent a decade working for various design consultancies as a graphic designer, including a stint in Milan and working for the demanding Terence Conran. But like many creative beings, she wanted the freedom to express her own view of design rather than being an instrument of others. In 1991, she went into partnership with Jane Chipchase. It ended 2 years later when Chipchase joined Pentagram. Morag decided to start her own company, not only continuing with graphics, but collaborating with architects to design environmental elements, signage and exhibitions, giving her a chance to think beyond two dimensions. But she would have to wait 25 years before she finally found what she was looking for to fulfill her creative potential. The first iteration of her now trademark creations came when she was asked to make a temporary structure on a development site next to a busy railway station in East London. Using traditional scaffolding, chipboard and paint, a cafe with a garden seating area appeared on the vacant space in just a few weeks, resulting in the Movement Cafe. It was an instant success, evoking a sense of fun with its use of joyful colours and enticing keywords that populated the structure, drawing in passers-by who loved the immediate sense of community. For Myerskoff, this was to be a turning point in her design direction. The appearance of her joyful structures trigger memories of childhood, the fairgrounds, end-of-pier arcade visits, or the circus. As it turns out, her grandfather was a circus act, and the DNA of his experience must have resurfaced in Morag. Since that first structure, she has made many around the world, all achieving the same magnetic draw to visitors. I met with Morag at her Hoxton studio, along with her West Highland Terrier, Elvis, who slept under the table during our chat, and accompanied by the sound of her partner, Luke Morgan, wielding an angle grinder in his own studio space deeper into the building. I kicked off by asking Morag to describe her very interesting sounding family and childhood.
I come from a very bohemian family who lived in a very working class area of Holloway. We didn't have any money, but there was a lot of creativity in the household. My father was a classical musician and also a session musician, and my mother was a textile artist. But we had cine films as well, so when you watch cine films, you remember those things that reoccur. I was the youngest. I've got one older sister. We were 18 months apart, and probably one of the most doomsday of my life was when my sister was born when I was five. And then I became the middle child, which does change the dynamic. So there was Shauna and I, and we were thick as thieves. And then there was my sister Ishbel. My father was very much about his art, his music, his family about food. My grandmother was French and they lived next door. And he wasn't really about buying a house to put his children in. So me and my sisters just had one room, which was in the front of the house. We had bunk beds from children to, you know, to leaving. And then Shauna left first and then I left slightly later. Right. But we, you know, all I had was a cupboard in the bedroom with my stuff in it. You know, I never had a big bedroom, and I don't think it did us any harm. My uncle lived next door with his wife and two children, and my grandmother and grandfather, my French grandmother and my grandfather. My grandfather was on the boats on the Queen Mary, so he wasn't there very much. Everybody would come in and out. It was a real sort of close family. Yeah. My mum was always making. My father was always practicing, or he was out of work. And then if he wasn't practicing, he would be making model boats. He was obsessed with making model boats.
So in addition to being a textile designer, your mother taught at the Chelsea Art School. I wondered, with all that creativity surrounding you, I would have imagine that Pimlico or the King's Road would have been a more your type of neighbourhood.
My dad didn't believe buying anything on HP, and I don't think he ever wanted a mortgage either. So it was that time in the 60s where it was about, it wasn't about what you owned, it was about the experience of life. Yeah. And my father believed that he didn't want to kill himself working every second of the day, because his friends who used to do sessions, they'd do 4 or 5 sessions a day, and then they'd do Talk of the Town, and then they'd never come home. Yeah. Whereas my dad would prefer to do 2 or 3 sessions a day, and he loved my mum so much, and he liked coming home, having dinner, a glass of wine. Yeah. And his expectations of us were phenomenally high.
Were you very academic at school?
I was, to begin with, because I went, my parents couldn't afford to send us to anything, and didn't want to. So we went to the same school as my dad went to in Holloway. My family have lived in the same place since 1870 for a really, really long time. Okay. And then I got my 111, which I think is your 11 plus or whatever. I didn't even know I was taking it, because I really was brought up in Islington experimental teaching. Like, 1 year I just painted all year, and my mum went up to school going, "Can't you teach her to read?" And you know, so I had every experimental class, because it was that time in Islington where they did all the teaching tests. So the fact that I got a 111 was quite a miracle. And then I went to Highbury Hill High School, which was a grammar at the time, which wasn't a very, it was all right, wasn't a very good grammar. It didn't really have massive expectations of the girls. We were really sort of meant to just go and be a PA or something.
So when did your creative side begin to surface?
Because my grandmother was a milliner for Hartnell's as well. And so she made hats all the time. And also very, she was very chic and coutured her clothes and things. And I naturally went to sewing and textiles and making things. So when my mum used to teach at Chelsea, I used to go to her classes and being in her class. And I wanted to do mine City and Guilds when I was like 12. And I belonged to the Young Embroiderers, and I had my work exhibited at the Commonwealth Institute. And so I did embroidery and textiles. I just make everything. My mum used to dye fabric and dye wools, and I would do all that. And that's where I think my understanding from colour from a very early age, because I didn't, if you dye something with onions, it's very different to dyeing something with a chemical dye. And I knew those differentiations from teeny. Yeah. I mean, there's pictures of me sewing with my mum and my other sister from very small. Because we lived in such a small house, there weren't special rooms that people went to. You either did it in the same place, and then my dad would want to practice, and then we'd all have to go out and into the kitchen or something. So everything was all together.
This notion of making things rather than, say, music, I guess, stuck with you.
Yeah, I mean, I had a real thing that I wish I could play an instrument, but what I always thought about playing an instrument in the way my father did, and it was of the highest level, he did the Wigmore Hall, and he went to the Royal Academy with his brother when he was 14 or something. It was about shutting yourself away in a room, repeating the same thing until you got it right. Yeah. Whereas I used to watch my mother, and she, between cleaning and washing and various things, which I decided I did not want to do, I never wanted to iron on a Sunday night, she used to do a drawing. Right. She'd sit, like, as a rest, she'd have a cup of tea and she'd draw a flower or something like that. And for me, that felt a much nicer space to be. She could do that in the kitchen with everybody, and we were just there. And then also she had this drawing at the end of it, which I know is naive, because the music is a whole different, it's not a visual thing, it's a whole different thing. But for me, there was that drawing, and that felt more tangible for me than sitting doing my scales, partly because I wasn't a particularly good musician, and I never really got past a level. I think if you get past a level with music, then it's unbelievable.
How did you fare at the grammar school?
Because my father was really wanted us to be academic, and I do remember I once got 98 in geography. And he told me to why I didn't get 100, so I had to go back to the teacher and ask them, and the teacher was practically crying and said it might have been your handwriting. So my older sister became a family law solicitor, and in a way then the pressure was slightly off me, I think, possibly, in the sense that she had gone and done that, and then when I was doing all these A-levels and then I felt that actually I wanted to go to art school. So I just said that that's what I was going to apply for. And my head teacher at the time was a female, and I told her that I wanted to give up biology and I wanted to go to art school. And she said, oh, you'll never make a living from that. And I thought, but my mum and dad feed us. I think I can live from that. But because there was that much pressure on that, I think the moment I went to art school, I never felt I could do fine art. I felt that I had to go and make a living from that, because I'd had this, like, wasn't so much my parents, it was more pressure around that I had to go and do that. Whereas Ishbel, my younger sister, who ended up going to City Girls because she was bullied at school, my parents wanted to have a good education, she did become a fine artist, you know, because I think within that school, maybe there was more confidence within that school than maybe it felt when I was in the school I was in. Yeah.
Then you went on to do a foundation course at St Martin's and later the BA course. Was St Martin's a revelation to you?
So there again, I was directed towards design without my choice, but maybe they saw it in me, because I actually cleared my mum's house out the other day and I read a report, and even then when I was at school they said I seemed to go towards design. So maybe that's what the tutors saw in me, and they directed me in design workshops or whatever. And then it was natural for everybody they were at St Martin's to apply to St Martin's, but I decided that I needed to go and look at everywhere. So I went to Chelsea and Middlesex at the time, which were really important colleges, and some others. And then in the end, I did decide St Martin's was the best to apply for. And then I got in doing graphics. And then I had this amazing tutor, Jeff Fowle, in the third year. And he absolutely opened my mind and told me that I could think in whatever way I wanted. And as long as I thought, you can't see this, but very high, then I could always come down a bit and I should never think low, you know. So he opened my mind.
After St Martin's, you went on to the Royal College of Art, where you were taught by Derek Birdsall and Gert Dunbar, two very different designers with different approaches. Did you continue in your single-minded way, or were the tutors as inspiring as Jeff Fowle to give you that intellectual lift?
Again, I wasn't the person they expected to get into the Royal College, and I was the only girl from our year at St Martin's. And that year, actually, was a very small year. We had 17 students in total in my year, I think it was, and only about 4 were women.
So were you doing graphics at the Royal College?
It was graphic art and design. So because I continued that, and my final work at the Royal College was the opera sets, because I was obsessed by opera at the time, The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, and I reinterpreted the libretto. But the response to that was, again, Morag, you're never going to get a job. They never said to me at that time, you could go and do theatre work, or you could go and do another degree. They all just said, and everybody was desperate to find me a job. So Derek was going to take me on to help him with his magazine. You know, he was on the Independent magazine at the time, and he wanted me to help me there. I just thought, God, I'm like 20 at that time, and I just don't want to be here.
So you didn't take up the offer of working in the smoke-filled haze of the Independent magazine. Instead, you landed a job at the design consultancy Lamb and Shirley, who'd made a name for themselves producing the very successful mail order catalogue for the Next fashion chain. And you were let loose on that.
Well, it employed loads of, you know, Why Nots were doing things, and Tim Hopgood and the girl who used to design IT, and all, you know, they had a load of really exciting people. And I was given, and I did number 3. So I designed all the cover, all the insert pages, my very first job. And I went out to Italy to printers. What an amazing start to your career. You know, that was super excited. And what was so brilliant about Tim Lamb, actually, is he saw something in me, and all his seniors decided to leave. And he just said to me, look, I've got all these seniors and they want this. And so within 3 months of working there, he made me the senior designer. But also what I was doing at the same time, I was doing lots of illustration work. So I would go in and work during the day. I'd work all night, freelance money. And then I started getting to know architects. So I did freelance work all the time and then work during the day. And Tim didn't mind. And then he let me teach. I went to teach at St Martin's one day a week. So I taught from 1990 or something, 1989, maybe earlier, till 1997. With Jeff Fowle in the third year, one day a week.
You then took up the you took up a post in Milan working for the architect and ex-member of Memphis, Mikhail DeLucchi, where you were in charge of graphics. How did you find working in Italy?
I came in and there was a job and I was down in the basement and I ran his graphics for him. What I loved about Italy, the design process, is it felt that there was no limitations. If you wanted to design a building, a piece of furniture, that was all right if you were an architect. Yeah. But if you were a different discipline, it was a whole different thing. And also, although I had a great time there and it was an amazing way of life, I decided that a woman there had a limit. Very, very male dominated. And it was such an incredible hierarchy there. You'd go into these studios and the male boss would sit always high up and look down on everybody. It was an amazing experience. And I met Lee McQueen and he became my friend, Alexander McQueen.
In 1999, you formed Myerscough and Chipchase with designer Jane Chipchase.
That's right.
And that lasted, I think, a couple of years until Jane left to join Pentagram. Was that difficult? And what did you do then?
I decided that I would set up on my own, totally on my own. But I was too scared at that time, which I realise now was a mistake, to call myself Morag Myerscough, because I felt that that meant I was a freelancer. I wanted to be considered as a studio because I was used to doing big projects. I did British Rail clothing guide as well. You know, when I was at La Mancheria, I worked on big things and I didn't want to just do small things all the time.
I take it you were mostly doing graphics for print?
Print work, pre-computer and paste. I decided then I would set myself up as Studio Myerscough, and I had my studio and it was just me and I was sitting in a room on my own and I used to get really nervous phone calls. Then Simon, a student I had at St Martin's, then came and joined me. I just had space, you know. When I set up with Jane, I had earned a lot of money because at that time was when there was money and I'd done all this work, saved lots and lots of money. Then I went to Italy. Then when I came back, I set up and I had enough money to buy. At that time, I bought the computers and I got the studio. And I just wanted it to be a girl thing. And I sort of, not forced Jane, but I don't think she was totally ready. And then it got to a point where the recession hit and we weren't really making much money and she wanted to move on with her life and so she wanted to take the money out of the studio to do her bathroom up and I wanted to buy computers. So I thought that maybe that wasn't right. And then when it came to the crux of it, I just decided I don't think I could go back and work at that time and that's why I set up Studio Mask.
How did you go about getting work? That's always a tricky one.
So I'm not very good at that, I don't think. There was this amazing opportunity, and my memory in the detail is not so brilliant. But for some reason, I must have met Tim Malloy when he was running the Science Museum. And he then rang me up, and he said to me, Morag, have you ever done banners? And I said, no, but I'm happy to do that. He goes, OK, I've got this project. Maybe you're interested. And it ended up being, they were putting new lifts in the Science Museum, and it ended up being these hoardings over all the floors of the museum. He wanted me to cover them in art. But anyway, I did this project. And at night, my sister was at the Slade at the time, and all her friends at the Slade, we'd get them, we'd go and we'd go in at night and we'd make this big thing. And that was sort of my first taste of a really physical project like that. And it was amazingly exciting and I loved it. That was the beginning of that. When I was working with Jane, I did a lot of small projects with architects to make the old establishment of architects be aware of the young architects. And that's when I came across HMM.
After getting that early job for the Science Museum, you started to work for the architects Alfred Hall, Moynihan and Morris. And your large street concertina hoarding in the City of London, the British Land Property Company, advertising their new development, seemed to receive a lot of attention at the time.
So those two projects, right in the middle of the recession, were the things we did at that time. And I think that was the beginning.
Had you expanded at this point?
I actually had maybe eight people in my studio, seven or eight people. And so because basically all my work was really print and exhibitions. Yeah. And then I start, and I also did lots of work for the British Council, and those exhibitions built up over time as well. Then it grew. Yeah. But there was a point where I was a bit frustrated, and some architects I knew, Orange, worked for, Project Orange worked for Terence Conran. So Terence was bringing out this range, and he was either going to do it in-house, or I think I was up against Lippa Pierce and somebody else. And then in the end, I got the job and I worked for Terence for a year. I used to run my studio, which at that time was in Charterhouse Square. And I used to go there for 3 days a week, and then I'd run Studio Mayerskoff for 4 days a week, because I have always worked every single day. So there were 7 days in the week. Yeah. That's how it's always been. So 3 days over at Conran. And I did loads of things. I worked on all the Bluebird stuff, I did this full range of packaging for the food. And it was good. And what it taught me was, because I think sometimes when you're running your own business, you forget your own value, how much to charge. And because I knew they were paying me a certain amount and they were charging me at twice as much, I knew then when I went back to my studio that I could charge myself as twice as much. So it was a great experience for me, but I realised that you have to walk away from where you are, yourself in a different situation. I realised that I was making Terence Conran's visions realised. He wasn't allowing me very much to put my own input, and I just thought, Terence had his vision of what he wanted, and I did fight against that often, but then when I left, he put it back to what he wanted. So, you know, fair enough, though. I mean, you know, it was his company and he wanted it. And then I started doing pieces of work with the HMM in the build with the Orford Hall Monaghan Monitor Architect in the buildings that they were doing. So one of them was the Broadgate Gym, and I did a whole thing with haiku poems on the walls in the gym. Also I did the publications and things. And then I worked with Derwent London a lot and did their designed the tea building, because I wanted to use the Cabussier, what I thought was the Cabussier stencil on his drawings. And I was talking to Alan Fletcher, and Alan Fletcher said to me, Morag, there's this place in Paris, just go there and they'll have those stencils. And I was expecting to go to some like tiny little typographic shop. It was like in a department store, and it was just the household stencils. And I was so naive. And I think they sell them now in SCP, but at that time, you know, it seemed a very continental thing, you know, very international.
You then embarked on buying a property that you could both live in and work in. How did that work out?
HMM gutted it and I built it, made it into my studio for a while downstairs. And that's when we had 6 or 8 people. Then that was too small for us. So I got a studio down the road in one of the warehouse buildings, and I made what was my studio into a kitchen. And then I lived there on my own. And I thought that it would be interesting, because it was a shop front, to make a gallery, that it was my kitchen at night and it was a gallery during the day.
Around this time, you struck up a relationship with the musician Luke Morgan, and you described him as your muse. Now, that's very special. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, I met him at a party, actually. I'd sort of stopped a relationship with somebody else, and I met him at this party, and I, you know, it wasn't one of those things where you're looking, but then that's sometimes when you find somebody. Anyway, I went out with him. And then what I thought was so fascinating about him is, when I was at college, all the guys, mainly the guys, were rockabillies and psychabillies and stuff. And then I meet this guy like 20 years later, and he's still a psychabilly. And I thought, wow, that's a bit weird, isn't it?
I think you need to explain psychobilly to the listeners.
So psychobilly is fast rock and roll, and it was an 80s phenomena, really, and it was a genre of music that people followed. It sort of came out of punk as well, but more playful. So Luke has like mohawks and all sorts of things. And it just had this realization to me that sometimes it's too easy just to almost forget who you are inside and just run a business or think you're meant to be doing this because other people are doing this, like having 20 people working for you or whatever, you know, just getting in that sort of treadmill of things. And he suddenly made my mind stop, that maybe I was starting to lose myself, that I didn't really enjoy running a studio. I was bored majority of the time. time, I did find the work very easy and it didn't use a lot of my brain. And I didn't know if I could actually keep myself interested for another 20 years. So at that time, in a way, he just came along at a time where I was frustrated. And I wanted to express myself, because I think when I was at college, it was all about expressing myself. And then when you work, it's all about expressing everything for everybody else, never putting your name on it, never anybody really knowing who you are. And I did even have this instance where I was out somewhere, it was some DNAD thing, and this guy said to me, "Oh, what's your name?" And I said, "Morag Myerscough." And he went, "Oh, who are you then?" And I said, he goes, "Oh, do you work for somebody?" And I said, "Studio Myerscough." And he goes, "Yeah, I know. Oh yeah, Studio Myerscough, they're great." I was like, right, okay, so I'm that anonymous? So then after that, I decided this is crazy. You know, I am the person who's making this work, because I only ever had one or two people. It wasn't like, oh, well, I was lying on the sofa and everybody else was doing the work. I was doing the work. So then I thought, wow, I've got to start doing something for myself. So then also with meeting Luke, there was this thing where he had always kept to the way he was. Nothing had ever changed him, but that didn't make it bad, that made it good, because he sort of felt strong with the tribe. He had a belief in what he was doing. And then that made me start realizing that I had to have that belief that I had previously. And then we started making these products, and then we went into Designer's Block. At that time, though, everybody at Designer's Block was in their early 20s. You know, we were already, I was like 37. And I remember having a stall out at Designer's Block in Milan, and this woman came around from the British Council, because I had been designing big exhibitions for the British Council. I was quite known in that way. And this woman's like going, "Why are you here, Morag? Why are you doing this? Why are you standing next to a stall here?" And I was like going, because this is really important, because I need to get people to understand actually how I think rather than how I think for everybody else. Because I used to be, everybody loved it when I worked on big projects, because I was like a method actor. I would take on that subject. Yeah. I would know that subject. I'd know the company better than the people who own the company. And then I would give them more than they ever wanted, you know. But I never got anything back.
So you perhaps wanted a clearer identity?
In a way, I wanted it to be a bit more of a two-way street, in a way. It wanted to be just about me, but it wanted to be about actually what I thought, rather than me reading minds for other people, you know, also, rather than me just making it happen for other people.
When did you feel that you had finally found the thing that had been lurking in your head but was never allowed to surface?
It was an amazing moment for me, actually. It was in 2012, so we're only talking 7 years ago. And Martin Evans, who now works for You and I, and Richard Upton, they had a company called The Cathedral, and it was just coming up to the Olympics. And I had done a lot of projects with them. In 2010, I did a big project with them in the vinyl factory. And I had started expressing myself, but not in this three-dimensional way that piece of work. So anyway,
was this the Movement Cafe?
This is the Movement Cafe. So it was at the time in 2012 where there were lots of building sites, but people were holding off building, so there was an encouragement to do meanwhile spaces there until the money was raised to be able to build the thing. The councils were pressurizing developers, like, you just can't leave that waste ground there. And at this moment in time, this waste ground was right next to the Greenwich, when the equestrian events for the Olympics came out, you'd have to come out of this station to get there, and it was a big piece of waste ground. And basically, Martin, who is an amazing person who's always believed in my ability, but then I think the right project has to come out as well to be able to, said, and Richard said, "We've got this piece of ground, we've got like 6 weeks, we want to put a cafe here. Morag, come up with something." And I've got to say, I did designers, artists, whatever block. I had block for quite a long time, and I was petrified. And to a point where I couldn't put anything out. I couldn't do anything. I was just like, everything wasn't good enough. You know, I was really scared. And then I went to the meeting, and Richard Upton basically said to me, "Have you done anything, Morag?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm going to be doing something. I've nearly done something." He goes, "Morag, if you don't do it tonight, that is it. You've lost the job." And so I went home, and that was the best thing anybody could have said to me, because I had been working with the poet Lem Sizay on a permanent piece that was going to happen there, but it was held off. And we had been talking, I'd been collecting my colour tweets, and he'd been around here, and he does a tweet every day about how he feels or the weather or, you know, expressive tweet. And I just sat, for some reason, read one of his tweets. It just said something to me. It was about chance meetings, eye contact. It was just something. And then I just thought, this is it. And Luke had gone out to the pub or something with his friends, and I was just at home. And then I just made this model, like made it. It just happened. I printed the words out and made this thing. And then he came home and I said, look, Luke, this is the cafe. This is it. And he was like, yeah. And I sent it over to Richard and they said, yeah, we'll build it. We'll make it. And then that moment, I'd been waiting for that moment for 25 years to happen.
So this was the final transition from Morag, the graphic designer, to Morag, the creator of living, breathing environments. You'd made a place.
It was a place. And I'd worked also for 20 years. You know, I worked on the Barbican. I worked with Ian on the Tate. I'd already done Westminster Academy 2007 by then. I did 11 schools I worked on with art pieces in them and everything, but not this standalone, not this piece that was completely out of my head, you know, that made this thing.
I've always imagined you as a young girl obsessed with making spaces, maybe under the kitchen table out of cardboard boxes or something.
Well, I had a cardboard spaceship, and I often show that in my talks. My mum gave us a cardboard spaceship, and my sister and I used to travel around space. And I always remember that as this sort of this way to take yourself into another place, because and also my French grandmother came from this family in Paris. Her father was a painter, quite glamour, you know, quite glamour. Came to Holloway, which was a very, very different environment, was put in this terraced house. It was pretty grim, tenanted house. And then she got all her family to make this French salon for her. Honestly, if you went in there, it's still there. It's still exactly as it was. And I mean, she died in 1977, but my aunt is the only person now who's living in that house. It is still everything in the French salon. And my grandmother did that because when she came home at night, she wanted to have this space that was completely of how she wanted to live, even though it wasn't, it was a fantasy in a way.
So this must have all fed into Little Morag's creative hard drive for future use.
Exactly. But that's what I realise now. The more I work and the more I'm allowed in myself and with the projects that I take on, the more I realise that actually there is quite a lot I want to say, and there is a lot related to my family. And so with the Temple of Agape, that was another one where I just did that one. The three dimensions was built from a sketch. So sometimes I think I have either dyslexic drawing three dimensionally. I cannot draw very well. I can't draw perspective in a drawing. I find that I don't know why. So for many years, I felt that my drawing wasn't very good because it's just the way I do it. And now I realise that that is a way I can express myself, even because I can see it in 3D.
Your drawings are very two-dimensional in design form.
They're flat facades often, but I always know how everything else is working. And so then what we do, and often, although I'm getting better at it now, Luke will draw it with me in SketchUp. So then we then build the thing that is in my head in SketchUp. But I can't draw that by pen. I find that that's just a part of my brain.
So touching on that working relationship with Luke, tell us a little bit more about how that worked.
He feels a little bit, because now my SketchUp abilities have improved vastly because I'm forcing myself to do it. So he says he's a little bit redundant. But well, what's really wonderful is when I do work with Luke, is that you can talk to somebody as well. You know, and also the pieces where we really collaborate is where it's maybe, I love mechanical sculptures, but I'm not very mechanical. You know, I like structures, physical building shapes and all that stuff, but I'm not very mechanical, but I know things I like, and Luke is very mechanical. And so when I'm going, oh, we want to make a sign that moves this way or something, then he can work. So I always describe Luke as being an inventor. So he's sort of, we talk about it and he'll realize those things with us. So
inventor, artist situation. You
know, yeah, it's. I think inventor artist. I think is because visually Luke is a lot darker than me, and I'm more in this happy world, and he's in a slightly more dark. And so when it comes visually, all the two-dimensional work. I mean, you know, Luke doesn't. You know, doesn't get involved. The bandstand Luke didn't get involved in, but we're doing a massive project in Manchester, and he's involved in that. So it depends on the project and whether he wants to be involved in it as well.
So can you tell me how you actually make these constructions? Because at one point, I know you had a collective called Supergroup. How did that come about?
Why supergroups existed in the first place is because I worked on a lot of projects with the architect who used to teach at the Royal College, Gerard O'Carroll, who died in 2010. But we did the RCA show. I don't know whether you remember the big great facade, and we did all that, and we worked on all these projects. And we worked on British Council projects and Design for London projects in China at the Biennale and various things. And what we were finding is that there was a group of us, different people. It was a curator, it was me, it would be Luke, it would be Gerard. And then on the board, we couldn't put all our names, or it just got really confusing. So just before Gerard was diagnosed with cancer, we discussed it and we thought, actually, why don't we have a collective and call it Supergroup? And so we, and that was particularly for when we did Shanghai. And then sadly Gerard died, and I thought it was a nice way of grouping people together when we did projects. But as the time went on, it seemed really that it was just me and Luke doing things. And so then it was better that I named Luke when he was working on a project with me, and I named myself. Otherwise, we were going to get back into the situation that I had with Studio Myerscough. So now what happens is Supergroup doesn't sort of exist, but depending on the project, I was asked to do an installation in Aberdeen, and my mum and dad met in Aberdeen by chance. So I made an installation called Love at First Sight. And really what's come out of Supergroup actually is about working collaboratively. But in the end, the groups of people are people in their own right as well. And so I worked with the Doric poet there, and then she fed into she wrote poems in the piece, and then right. But then also, because some of my projects can cost a lot of money, the people who want to do it may not have as much money as possibly the project would be if you costed it out by using people that you know, companies to fabricate it. So I also work out a way, if you are ambitious with the project, how can we make that happen? What will people get out from doing it if there isn't money involved? Mm-hmm. So if people work for me in London and I'm getting paid for a job, they get paid. Yes. A London hourly rate, that's absolutely. But in other places, like for example, the project in Aberdeen, they didn't have money, so they just got all the students and things, and then I went up for 4 days, taught them how to paint in the way I wanted to. Then two amazing girls, who I think they obviously did pay, they ran it for 3 weeks, and then they painted this massive thing, and it was so beautiful when it was up and all these people were coming down, and it was like mums and dads and kids, and you know, and they were like, we painted this bit and we paint, and then they'd made this piece themselves. So there's a festival called Look Again in Aberdeen, which is an amazing group out of the art school, and they put on a festival each year. And it was about, their brief to me originally was they wanted people to re-look at areas in the city. So where the Market Cross was traditionally a really important part of the city, but now it's just full of drunk people and, you know, it's not really used. And so it was actually getting the people in the city to re-look at their city. So that was their brief. And then I brought my own brief on my mum and dad, because also my mum had just died. It was a weird moment. My mum had died in December, and then out of the blue, these people call me from Aberdeen to make a piece of work. And I'd never been to Aberdeen before, and my mum and dad met in Aberdeen. My mum taught at Gray School of Art there as well. So it made it very poignant.
You're now very well known in the creative community with many honours and awards, along with making and lecturing around the world. How do you see yourself developing, and is there anything you'd love to do that you haven't done?
I'm going to India in January, and I've just been made an honorary RIBA, the first time ever for all women fellows this year. I'm doing a big project in Manchester at the moment, and that's, I wouldn't have even known that I might dream of this project, so that's quite lucky. You know, that's exciting in the sense that it's an exciting project. I think I've always had a desire to build my own house or something, and to build on top of here, to do something that will last outside, you know, because my thing is temporary, and I feel very conscious about sustainability and about making pieces, and more with my work. From the very beginning, I talk to people about what materials they're using, what are they going to do with it afterwards, repurposing it and things. And I think we've got to be very aware of that, and especially with temporary. And when I did the temple, the South Bank said, you know, there's no way they couldn't keep it at all. So I kept the whole of that and bought a storage space to put it in, and it's still in there because with other things. So, and I have plans for that, though, to make a new piece of work with that work. But now I'm managing to have that conversation from the very beginning, because the problem is you need to actually, before you start, place it afterwards, because there's a moment where you've got this big physical thing and people get freaked out and they go, oh, we haven't got any storage, are we going to just chuck it? You know, so you have to plan it well in advance. So with the big piece I did in the Barbican, we gave that to a school. The big piece I'm doing in Africa, there's this great group called Seesaw Do, and they take all the panels and then they redistribute it in townships, either cladding buildings or put it in libraries, or because I paint on FSC rated wood as well, so and I use all water-based paints. That it's finding, it's not about recycling it in the sense of putting it in a recycling bin and chopping it up and making it. It's actually physically keeping it in this world in its form of some form, but the panels, and then, you know, and there's many things people can do with it. And just one project I'm talking about at the moment, they're using a material that worried me, but they said that they'll make clothing out of it and they'll make shoes out of it, and that this is in India. So I said, okay, then I'm okay with that. So we come from a time where you printed more stuff than you needed. You did everything more than you needed. And actually now you should think, do you need that? And if you don't need it, don't print more of it. Just print less of it. And then if you need some more, if it's necessary. And that's why I don't spend my days painting lots of more paintings. I think I'm very much like a designer like that, in the sense that I make something for the thing that I'm doing. I don't sit here. I don't want to generate lots and lots of things.
Now, a question I always ask my guests, on behalf of all those budding designers out there that would like to follow in your footsteps, and this conversation has already revealed a lot of really good advice, but do you have any more little pearls that you'd like to pass on?
I think you should think of your career as being for a long period of time, and it will change. You know, like you might get married 3 times and in your career you might change it as you go along. You don't necessarily, you know, I feel like I'm in this very different phase. I really respect the phase I was in earlier, and I was very good at it and I earned a lot of money, and that is what I wanted to do at that time, and I knew how to earn money and that was great. But maybe to me it didn't have enough purpose, it didn't fill my heart with what, you know, what I thought I was here to do on this earth sort of thing, you know. And now I feel that I'm doing what I was here to do, but then at the same time I've been lucky because I've had a continuous career, in the sense I've never had a break. It's only about me. You know, I mean, you know, in the sense myself is the way I've been, and that's selfish, I know. So what I would say to people is, I know you want everything to happen to you absolutely immediately, but what you've got to do is make things happen, but they may not always be the end thing. You don't want to get to the end thing straight away. And I think that's what I feel really pleased about, is that I had to wait for the world to change for me to be able to do my work that I'm doing now. But I was lucky that I was still at a point to make that happen. I could have missed it. You know, I could have, it could have gone by me and I would never, I'd been frustrated or what, you know, or never been able to realise what I could do. And I'm just feel so lucky that I totally have realised what I'm capable of. And that can happen to you any time in your life, though.
I think the takeaway from our chat is believe in yourself. Don't be afraid to make change.
But also being giving yourself, don't bog yourself down with possessions and belong, you know, but giving yourself enough freedom to be able to respond to that moment in time, not to be so held down by commitments around you or something, you know.
Well, I'm looking forward to your next creation. I think you call them radical free expressions. So that'll be exciting. Morag Myerskoff, thank you.
Thank you, that was great.